All right, hello everybody, and happy Friday.
Oh, I thought you were going to wish yourself a happy birthday.
And happy birthday.
To?
Me.
You.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't even want to talk about it.
25.
I'm tired of collecting birthdays. Had enough. It's all right, though. It's
gotta
actually
collect something.
It's nice.
Having records.
Right, exactly. Having a birthday. Good point. And it's better than not collecting birthdays.
Yes.
And it's on a Friday. I like Friday's birthdays. It's kind of cool. I'm done with work.
It's
maybe
party birthday.
You're listening as well, so we can all celebrate. I can celebrate with our listeners.
Yay.
A little party. Yay. The American Hit Radio party.
Do we have like noisemakers?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Good enough.
How sad.
This is what it's come to. Well, I am really glad to be here. As I said, I'm really glad to have you aboard for listening as well. I am your host, Tom Ryan. With me, my lovely co-host and wife bride, Heidi Morales Ryan, to bring you the Friday edition of our program. Actually, on Friday, we changed the name a bit. We call it How Music Changed. We have 250
Why?
Topics that we have chosen as being among the most important things that have happened to music in the past century or thereabouts. And we just pretty much run through those 250 subjects one at a time. Do we do one show on each of those subjects? No. We didn't. For example, when we did Motown, we did nearly 70 shows. Now, we happen to be covering the British Invasion. And it's been
and
one of the...
And if you missed them...
Well, this has been one of my most fun topics so far. I'm loving cover. It's just been great. The British Invasion is just such an interesting thing to do.
Yeah.
The music is great. And you're watching the music change throughout the 60s through the British Invasion and the British influence by doing this. And it's been really fascinating. This is show number 13 dedicated to the British Invasion. So the time period that we are covering now is going to be all from the summer of 1966.
Ooh.
So if, like me, you were under the mistaken presumption that the British Invasion happened in 1964 and then it sort of went away, we're here to prove otherwise. I mean, there are very few times in the history of music when so much musical innovation was happening at the exact same time. And I'd go so far as to say that perhaps the summer of 1966 might have outstripped any other time period as far as innovation, including the Summer of Love, the much, you know, lauded
yes.
Summer of Love from 1967. Let's see what happens. The show starts off with a bang or with a huge orchestral swirl. Probably one of the most bombastic songs ever to come out of England and sung by nobody less than Dusty Springfield, fairly incredibly. The song is You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. I'm sure you know it, but I want you to check this. The thing to listen to on this song from my perspective right now is this unbelievable orchestral swell that kicks it off. You'd swear that it was a Cecil B. DeMille movie and Moses is parting the Red Sea as this song begins to just, you know, thrust itself at you and build to this incredible climax. And in the hands of a lesser singer, they would have been forced to oversing the song, doing all the vocal histrionics and the jumping and the leaping and everything else. Dusty Springfield has such good taste that she actually sings the song in a restrained manner, which is why I think this song is still a masterpiece. Lets the orchestra do all of the overwrought stuff, and she holds it together while she sings what might be one of the saddest love songs of all time. It's called You Don't Have to Say You Love Me.
Aww.
When I said I needed you, you said you would always stay. It wasn't me who changed, but you. And now you've gone away. Don't you see?
That is a big arrangement. Now, that was originally, I guess it probably stands to reason, that was actually originally an Italian song, an Italian arrangement.
Oh, yeah, that does sound vaguely familiar now that you mention it.
Lo che non vivo.
But that was a common thing, right? Especially like in the 50s where they used to take different songs from different countries and kind of transliterate them.
Yeah, I guess it was. Well, this in this instance, they did write new American, English lyrics.
Yeah,
American,
get it listen straight.
To me. But I think the thing that really brought it to light was, this is around when I don't know if it was the beginning or what, but the European Song Festival or the Euro Song Festival was a regular occurrence. And this is where every country would put in their one song, just basically to determine cultural dominance of the pop charts sort of thing. It's pretty much how ABBA got their start later on in the 70s by working that route. But here in the 60s, this was Italy's entry, and I guess that gave it some international recognition throughout Europe, which is how it got heard and how Dusty Springfield picked it up, and why eventually it became a number four hit here in America as part of the British invasion, if you could imagine that. Now, as we continue our way through the British invasion, now, as I said, all this is coming out in the summer of 1966, a band that is now on its last legs. In fact, this is really the last song to come out by the Animals in their original incarnation. Ever a band shot themselves in the foot.
Who's the original incarnation again? Remind me.
We're talking with, what's his name? Of course, Eric Burdon.
Mm-hmm.
And Valentine was the name of one of the members of the band. The keyboard.
Well, just tell me who left then.
Well, pretty much everybody's gone at this point.
Oh,
except for Eric Burdon, and Eric Burdon is like keeping the name. And this is all because they were angry over the fact that their manager was giving them great songs that they didn't appreciate.
Oh, we don't like your great songs.
It's true. I mean, the last two songs that we played by the Animals were all great songs. Some
right.
of the most identifiable songs.
They need
songs.
To learn how to suffer in silence, okay?
Including this track. So after this came out, it was the last straw. The band essentially broke up after this track came out, and they never recovered from it. And I think it's another great example of the manager doing the right thing by them. But who am I to say? What's done is done. So it's all in the past now, but yet another classic track by the Animals. They should have heeded their own advice from the title. It's called Don't Bring Me Down.
Thank you. best just ain't good enough. Girl, I want to provide for you and do all the things that you want me to. But to give as well as take. One thing I need is your respect. One thing I can't take is your neglect. More than anything, I need your love. Then troubles are easy to rise above. I'm nothing in your eyes. It makes me feel like giving up, because my best just ain't good enough. Girl, I want to provide for you and do all the things that you want me to.
The Animals, with yet another great pop song. And it's so weird to think that they, I mean, now you think of, to me, after, say, House of the Rising Sun, which was their breakthrough single, which
right.
we played very early in our series
sure.
here. Really, the last three singles that we played, I think, are the most instantly identifiable Animals tracks.
Mm-hmm.
That track, Don't Bring Me Down, It's My Life, and We Gotta Get Out of This Place.
Right.
Those three songs, I think, are just great material. And they basically dislike it because they considered it to be too poppy. They said, oh, you're going to the same place. This is the same stuff you get for Herman's Hermits.
Oh.
You know, and it was so not that. You know, it was so much cooler. And I guess, you know, they were so obsessed with being authentic blues artists.
Right, but yet they weren't writing any of their own stuff, so.
Right, they and they were
so
caught
they
in that same trap.
So they should have learned how to cry all the way to the bank and shut their mouths.
Right, just shut up. It's a shame because that pretty much really is the end of the pop career for the Animals, more or less right there. I mean, Eric Burdon and the Animals did go back to the top 10 with the version of C.C. Rider, so we might be hearing that as we go forward. But after that, it pretty much just becomes, you know, really weird tracks like San Francisco Nights and stuff like that. And, obviously very different.
Some people love that.
Some people do. That's all I've got
to say.
We'll
just say it's
it.
Not the birthday boy.
Let me remind you that you are listening to the Friday edition of American Hit Radio. The station is WHPC, 90.3 FM, coming to you from Garden City, New York, in Nassau Community College. And I'm your host, Tom Ryan, with Heidi Morales Ryan. We are here every Wednesday and Friday at 5 p.m. to do basically what we're doing right now. Today's show is dedicated completely to the British invasion. It's our 13th show to do this. We've been covering it chronologically, starting in January of 1964. And with this show, number 13, we are in the summer of 1956. If you want to give us a call, you can. The phone's been ringing a lot already. 516-572-7440 is our number here. Also, since I'm going through all this already, I could mention, if you like the show, if say you want to hear this series, hear
yeah,
the songs.
Yeah, what if you missed something?
It's a lot of history we've been covering here. This is, as I said, this is show number 13. If you got some time on your hands and you want to hear the first 12, go to our website. It's really easy. Get to a computer. Whatever your search engine is, don't matter. Just type in American Hit Radio, and we'll pop right up. First choice. The shows are right there on the top of the page. Left side is Wednesday show. Right side is the Friday show. So check it out. You can do anything you want. That's American Hit Radio on any search engine. Meanwhile, last week, we played a Beatles A-side, and we never got to the B-side, which actually did chart a little bit later. The way it worked out was the A-side, being Paperback Writer, went to number one. And as you recall, around this time, what Billboard was doing was they'd assign one side the sales, and then either side would get credit for airplay.
I see.
So usually the B-side would have a very hard time getting a high number because it would be totally dependent upon how much airplay it was getting. But in the instance of the Beatles, that usually didn't hurt it too much. For example, in this instance, the B-side went to number 23. Now, the A-side was Paperback Writer. This Paul McCartney being quite innovative for the time in 1966. Leave it to John to take it all a step further and write what might very well have been one of the most innovative pop songs to have reached the charts up until this point. Well, McCartney is writing songs like Good Day Sunshine and the like for their upcoming album Revolver.
Mm-hmm.
Lennon kind of went in the opposite direction. They decided to write about rain. And then, because of the now more or less it's legendary influence that marijuana was having on John while he was in the studio and working on his tracks, he was cutting up tapes and laying them back in. And legend has it that he actually laid his own vocal in backward by accident. And during playback, heard it and said, "Oh, I'm keeping that." And that's exactly the way the song came out. So at the end, if you don't know what John's saying, he's singing the lyrics of the song backward. Simple as that. Here's the B-side of Paperback Writer called Rain. Beatles with Rain, one of my favorite two-sided singles of all time right there. Of course, I said Paperback Writer on the A side, Rain on the B side. That's Lennon at his best. Now, I keep saying that the summer of 66 was one of the most innovative times in the history of music, and I really aim to more or less prove that by the end of the show, because another thing that these shows have proven up to this point was that the Rolling Stones were very late bloomers as far as the British invasion was concerned. But by this point, they were doing a great job of going head-to-head with the Rolling Stones, almost single for single. You can almost hear how they're...
I thought you were going to tell me this show is proving that we have the smartest audience out there.
That too. It's awesome. You get all these calls, everybody's saying, like, you know, you mispronounced the name. And I'm like, I know. Oops. Actually, we just had Bobcat calling us, a friend of mine, who had mentioned the other names of the animals that I should have mentioned at that time, which was Hilton Valentine and Chaz Chandler, the man who eventually went on to become Jimi Hendrix's manager. So thanks for the tip and for reminding me what I should have remembered. It's hard when, you know.
You're getting old, you know.
Exactly. Things slip away.
You get some timers.
Anyway, back to the Rolling Stones now. By 1966, you know, Brian Jones is still playing a really key role with the Stones. In a lot of ways, he's just as responsible for what is going on with the band as Jagger and Richard are. Now, of course, Jagger and Richard are rising in their importance to the band because although Brian Jones always kind of fancied himself to be the leader, if you've got two of the guys who are writing all of the material and the material is now comparable to what is coming out of the Beatles camp, it's really hard to continue to call yourself the leader. But at this point in time, I would say that the three of them are firing on all cylinders. Everybody sounds great with what they're doing. And the rhythm section, of course, in their own, you know, loose, laid-back way, what's going on with Bill Wyman and Charlie Watts is pretty stunning in the mid-60s. And no band was as willing to write, I mean, not even the Kinks, not even Ray Davies, who would write these observational songs, which might be a bit wry and sardonic about the people that he's watching. Mick Jagger's no holds barred. If he wants to put somebody down, he doesn't
Slap.
Hesitate. Exactly. And this is probably one of the better put-down songs that was ever written by the Stones. So here it is, Mother's Little Helper.
What a drag it is getting old. Are different today. I hear every mother say, Mother needs something today to calm her down. And though she's not really ill, there's a little yellow pill. She goes running for the shelter of her mother's little helper, and it helps her on her way, gets her through her busy day. Things are different. Cooking fresh food for her husband's just a drag. So she buys an instant cake, and she buys a frozen steak, and goes running for the shelter of her mother's little helper. And to help her on her way, get her through her busy day. Doctor, please, some more of these outside the door. Don't appreciate that you get tired. They're so hard to satisfy. You can tranquilize your man. So go running for the shelter of a mother's little helper, and for help you through the night, help to minimize your flight. Doctor, please, some more of these outside the door. I hear every mother say, the pursuit of happiness just seems a bore. And if you take more of those, you will get an overdose. No more running for the shelter of a mother's little helper. They just help you on your way through your busy dying day.
Ending always cracks me up. It sounds like it's the way you would end, like, say, a wailing song. Hey! So, especially after this rant about, you know, the older generation and their addiction to, I guess, to mood-altering pills. It's kind of funny, actually, thinking about it now. I wonder if they could even do that song with any type of credibility now that the Stones themselves are, I guess they're in their 70s or real close, real close. No doubt about that. I'm sure, I'm almost positive that Bill Wyman is, but at the very least. Anyway, Heidi, the moment has come for you to basically go on your rant, because it seems like every show we have at least one Petula Clark song to play. And I know that you've always got something to say about Petula Clark, so I'm just going to say it up front and put
it out
there.
What do you mean? You already played a song by her, and I was on my best behavior.
No, I didn't play Petula Clark.
You didn't?
No, I played Dusty Springfield.
Oh, God, that's why I didn't mind it.
Now, it was a bit bombastic, so maybe you could have thought, or like a pop song, not really a rock and roll song,
mm-hmm.
which maybe would have made you think about Petula Clark. And I've been defending Petula on every one of our shows because, I'll tell you what, I think that the catalog of her songs up to this point is fantastic. Downtown, I Know a Place, Round Every Corner, A Sign of the Times, and this track. As far as I'm concerned, this is a song that Barry Manilow would have, like, lost an arm for if he could just to have gotten the credit for writing something like this. I'll be the first to admit, yeah, it's not rock and roll, but it's great pop music. And great pop music.
Look,
at a time
I've
when
been,
pop music
I've
mattered.
I've been framed.
How are you framed?
Because I'm not really a Pat Clark hater.
That's
just, I've been painted into a corner here.
All right, then. So, well, I think you did it to yourself, actually.
Wah.
You're the one who was calling her grandma. And go-go boots.
I know. I just like saying mean stuff. That's all.
Anyway, I think this is one of her better songs, and it actually went top 10 for her in the summer of 1966. Petula Clark with I Couldn't Live Without Your Love.
Bye.
You know, it's such a beautiful melody and such a, it sounds sugar sweet, that song, right? But if you listen to the lyrics, they're really kind of interesting. They're a bit provocative. Mm. It sounds, I mean, if you really listen to the lyrics, it's pretty much about a woman who falls in love with somebody who belongs to somebody else, and she has to steal him away.
Mm.
And like she says, you know, so I don't care. You know, if people want to stare, I know I don't really care because, you know, now I know you're really mine. It's like, you know, oh, okay. Kind of, you know, like I said, a bit provocative about taking somebody else's man and becoming a
separate
couple.
Yeah, it's funny
couple.
How people used to sing about all that and subject matter and sing it so innocently back
There's
in the day.
As much of an example of that as ever right there in that song. Because it just sounds like one of the most lighthearted and enjoyable and beautiful pop
songs.
Yeah,
you know? It's a summer day, strolling down the street,
right.
Stealing somebody's boyfriend.
Right. There's definitely an undertone
of a day.
There. Pretty incredible. Wow.
La-di-da.
Playing songs from the summer of 1966. And boy, what a time to own a transistor radio and have it tucked away under your pillow.
Sweet.
It's probably about what I was doing at around this time. Summer of 1966. I mean, from a personal perspective, I was 7 years old at this point. And
listening to Top 40.
I remember getting those seven, what are those little batteries, those 1.5,
nine
what are they
volt.
Called? Yeah, the 9-volt, thank you, the rectangular batteries that you'd have to put in your transistor radio.
You had to test it on your tongue.
Back then, the big stations were Zap. 66, which was WMCA, the good guys, and 77 WABC, ding. Remember that so well. And I mean, they'd be playing all of these songs, and it was just like, you know, it'd be just great. You just have the station tuned in, and you'd be listening with your friends, and you'd get an education on what was happening in pop music. And it didn't matter if you were 7 or 37, because the songs were good enough. They were talking to a very broad array of people. And people like Petula Clark in particular were actually covering that range, that age range, which is pretty phenomenal. Another artist who didn't really quite have the same broad range of
appeal,
age appeal, was Herman's Hermits. But, I mean, the facts speak for themselves. They were competing for being the best band of the most successful band of the British invasion, at least as much as the Rolling Stones were at this point. For example, today's track is their 10th single. Is that right? Nope, sorry, 11th single. And this is the only single since their debut that did not break the top 10. Every single one of them did break the top 10 until this.
Failure.
And yeah, and it's funny to call it a failure because this actually stalled at number 12. Aw, what a shame. Obviously, still at the top of their game, the Herman's Hermits with This Door Swings Both Ways.
Hello.
Everyone's life is bittersweet. It's a door that opens wide, and no man can call himself complete till he's seen it from both sides.
This door swings both ways. This door swings both ways. This door swings. Oh, fake ending there.
Interesting.
Don't know if you remember that
one. It goes in and out.
Yes, it does.
It goes both ways.
I kind of like listening to the old Herman's Hermit stuff now a little bit. It's appealing in a retro way. Even in its time, it was retro, really, a lot of their stuff. Uh-huh. I think like I'm Henry VIII, I Am.
Yeah.
It's obviously a very retro song. A lot of their stuff was. And that, in fact, I think that's what they realized was their main appeal in America, was that they could do things that would be considered incredibly like career-ruining in their own country that was actually considered charming in America.
I can't believe we're getting away with this.
Right. The real story, though, of 1966, though, was really like the birth pains that were being brought out by like the initial psychedelic stuff that was happening. And it was a while back, maybe four shows ago in our British Invasion coverage, when we played what I consider to be like maybe what could have been the very first psychedelic song ever. When we played up.
Are you going to remind me what it was?
Heartful of Soul by the Yardbirds.
Oh, yeah.
That goes all the way back to like July of 1965. And that has traces of psychedelia all over it. And from that point up until this point, for that entire year, the Yardbirds had proven themselves to be one of the most creative bands in music at that time, mostly because their lead guitarist, Jeff Beck, was a total madman.
He was.
Just out of
absolutely.
Out of his mind. Came up with like riffs that great guitar sounds. They were obviously more of a guitar band than any other band that was around at that time. They weren't afraid of abandoning their blues roots, which is how they had lost Eric Clapton in the first place.
Right. He had to move on.
Jeff Beck had no worries about that. He just wanted to be innovative, and that was easy for him. They were great songwriters, writing a lot of their own material, and this song basically...
Things got so much better anyway.
Yeah, I mean, really, just because it was that much more inventive.
Yeah.
Rather than worrying about copying a genre of a black man who is 30 years older than you in a different country, you could just be yourself. And when the Yardbirds learned to be themselves, they learned how to become great for that time period. And this track is definitely an example of that, maybe one of the best songs of their entire career. And listen to Jeff Beck on this. It's awesome. It's called Over, Under, Sideways, Down. I love it even more now than I did then.
It gets better and better.
It does. It just grows on me. You begin to like. It makes me laugh because it's so wild and crazy.
It's so crazy, yeah.
And a lot of times you can hear a song and not listen to the lyrics, thinking that they're sort of nonsensical. And that's another track where you start listening to it. You're like, oh man, this is really cool. This is a band that's singing about being a band and being a famous band in London and having a million things happening all at the same time and being the center of attention and how life is like got you so like running around that everything is over under sideways down. You know, very cool. Very cool. Now, the next track, we were talking about A-sides and B-sides, Heidi, earlier,
mm-hmm.
with the Beatles.
With the Beatles,
of course,
yes.
And how that always worked.
Paperback Writer.
Now the Stones are at the same game. The Stones are able to do the same exact thing at this point in time. And they do it by them putting a song. I guess they figured that it wouldn't have been a hit on its own, but I think that this song could have easily been a very big hit, a considerable hit, had it not been the B-side of Mother's Little Helper. But as such, it only went to number 24. We're talking about Lady Jane.
Oh, yes.
Essentially a madrigal by the Rolling Stones, which is so weird. I mean, you're talking about one of the most heavy...
And they wrote it about Jane Seymour, right?
I'm glad you brought that up because here's what I basically had to write about it because when I was investigating like what the song was about,
mm-hmm.
when I wrote my book, American at Radio, there was so many different explanations that... I'm just going to read the paragraph from what I wrote on that.
Okay.
The topic. First of all, it's like, was it about you know, as Jagger led his then girlfriend Chrissy Shrimpton to believe, the sister of model Jean Shrimpton, was it about her? And if it was, I wonder if she noticed that he got her name wrong. Or was it about Lady Jane Seymour, one of the six wives of Henry VIII? That was what the record company was trying to purport at the time. Which is ridiculous. Or maybe it referred to one of Jagger's royal acquaintances, Lady Jane Ormsby-Gore. And when he met her, Jagger would imply to her that he wrote the song about her as well. So
good move.
He would just tell anybody, oh, I wrote it about you. The other possibility is a lot of people thought that it might have been an obliquely veiled reference to the evil weed Mary Jane. You know? But considering the Stones, you know, as they were, I figured that the most licentious possibility is also the most believable. And if you check it out, Jagger, you found, was actually a fan of D.H. Lawrence,
mm-hmm.
the writer D.H. Lawrence. He's the guy that wrote the novel Lady Chatterley's Lover.
Uh-huh.
And in that book, one of the characters refers to her own private parts as Lady Jane.
Mm.
Now, of all the above possibilities, which one would you believe?
I'll go with the latter.
Yeah, me too. Here's the Rolling Stones with Lady Jane.
My sweet Lady Jane, when I see you again, your servant am I, and will humbly remain. Just heed this plea, my love, on bended knees, my love, I pledge myself to Lady Jane. My dear Lady Anne, I've done what I can. I must take my leave, for promised I am. My love, your time has come, my love, I pledge my troth to Lady Jane. Thank you.
my sweet Marie. I wait at your ease. The sands have run out for your lady and me. Wedlock is nigh, my love. Her station's right, my love. Life is secure with Lady J.
It still seems incongruous that Mick Jagger would be singing a song about chastity. Especially in 1966. I mean, think about it. This song, Lady Jane.
Yeah, but that was another common theme in rock and roll. Like, the Beatles were always crying about how they had lost a girl or they had had their heart broken. When you know that, obviously, they were having lots and lots of people throwing themselves at them.
Oh, yeah. No, you're right. It's a theme of pop music. And also, and even the fact that it sounds like that madrigal sound thing. I mean, there was that whole puffy sleeve element of rock and roll that was going on around 1966, where you could see the
medieval,
rock
and roll,
ye oldie rock and roll styles, you know, which is what's going on there. But it's kind of funny because, as you know, Lady Jean seems as if it's almost respectful of woman, and it's coming out at the same time as the album Aftermath, which has got songs on it like Under My Thumb. You know, the squirming dog has just had her day. It's incredible. Or another track called Stupid Girl. You're just a stupid girl.
Going to extremes here.
There was very little about what the Stones catalog that seemed to have much respect for women at all. So having this song come out in the midst of that was a bit stunning. On the B-side of Mother's Little Helper yet. So that's what it was like in the summer of 1966. And God bless you.
Thank you.
Right. We played a couple tracks in earlier shows by Manfred Mann, another band that was, I guess, a peripheral player during the British invasion. Most of their hits in America had nonsense titles, the biggest ones like Do Wah Diddy Diddy and Sha La La. Of course, we played both of those. One of their bigger hits in the future would be them doing an interesting cover of a Bob Dylan song that was from the Basement Tapes, Mighty Quinn. But before that, they released this track, and I guess maybe they thought, oh, geez, we need more songs with stupid lyrics, because when we sing about things, they don't really chart as high. But I vaguely remember this, and I wonder if you do. This went to number 29 for the group Manfred Mann. It's called Pretty Flamingo.
She roars, she moves so fine, like
Manfred Mann with Pretty Flamingo. I like that song. I still like that song quite a bit.
I can't say that I remember it at all.
Yeah, like I said, it wasn't their biggest hit. But I'm not sure. I think it had been covered by somebody along the line, and because I know I've heard other versions of it. And it's nice to hear the original there by Manfred Mann.
It must have not had very much longevity on the charts.
Probably, if it peaked at number 29, it certainly didn't. It wasn't around for a very long time. But definitely one of the songs of the British Invasion, and something that went on to have some impact as well for some artists. Same with this next artist now, Donovan. Up until this point, the summer of 66, I want to say it was like something of a joke, but it was very difficult to take him seriously at this point because of the Dylan comparisons. Dylan had that whole movie about Don't Look Back when he was in Great Britain in 1964, and there's even this this footage of a very young Donovan coming in to meet Bob Dylan, and the whole point was like, what are you imitating me for? He had on that PCAP thing, and he was singing. I mean, just because he was a young guy with curly hair that sang folk songs in England, and there's Dylan promoting his own stuff and meeting Donovan, must have been very uncomfortable.
Confrontational.
Literally very uncomfortable for Donovan. I give him a lot of credit for holding his own and being able to stay in the room and not look like a total fool, because he does seem to hold up okay. Mm-hmm. Under that sort of like scrutiny. But he had that one hit in America, which came out and actually in May of 65, Catch the Wind. And he was off of the top 40 since then. And all of a sudden, 1966 rolls around and he comes back gangbusters. He changes his style somewhat. He goes electric, which was inevitable.
To be done.
Right. I mean, like that. And he starts really becoming the most hippified songwriter you could possibly imagine before there was any real such thing as hippies, really. Maybe at least not in the popular sense. Donovan, without a doubt, though, basically represented the hippie ideal as much as any human being possibly could. First of all, I don't think it's possible to sound more optimistic than Donovan did on his records. He just sounds so optimistic that it almost seems laughable today. How that could have possibly happened. But don't forget, the time was 1966. This is before there was much trouble. There wasn't many protests against the war. Pop music was raging. The youth movement was actually all about, fun and music. And it wasn't politicized at all yet.
Peace signs and flowers.
Really, just the peace sign was beginning to come out. And Donovan exemplified all of that completely. I mean, he was so optimistic when he originally wrote this song. You know what it was called? His working title was For John and Paul. And that was the way it was going to come out, like his tribute to the Beatles.
Aww.
At the last minute, he decided to change it to some of the words, which reflected the optimism of the song. As I said, a number one hit from the summer of 1966. Here's Donovan with Sunshine Superman.
Sunshine came softly through my window today. Could have tripped out easy, but I've changed my way. It'll take time, I know it, but in a while you're gonna be mine, I know it. We'll do it in style. Your girl.
that you can have all your own. When you've made your mind up forever to be mine, I'll pick up your hand and slowly blow your little mind. When you've made your mind up forever to be mine.
And another hour bites the dust. Incredible. I thought I was going to get in a ton more music. Oh, that's what happens when I talk too much, right?
Oh, well.
By the way, name the guitar player on that track before we go.
I don't know.
Come on, you should know. The most famous, only the most famous session player coming out of Great Britain at that time.
Jimmy Page.
You got it. That's Jimmy Page on guitar on that track. All right, well, I hope you enjoyed this hour dedicated to the British Invasion. We will be back next Friday with part 14 dedicated to the British Invasion as we cover the fall of 1966. And of course, we'll be here on Wednesday as well. And we take a good hard look.
Hurry
at
up, because I want to tell you happy birthday.
October of 1966. Thanks, everybody, and look forward to seeing you then. And happy birthday to me.
Yeah.
Bye, everyone.